Alright, hi everybody and welcome to Lecture 32. Today's topic is the breakup of European Christianity. So, what we are doing, in essence here, in this part of our story, is we are trying to look for the major events from the past that have changed the world into the one that we live in. Our purpose in studying history, right, is not merely to know about things in the past. That is a perilous perspective. To suppose that history is merely the study of the past puts us in the wrong frame of mind with regard to history. It sets us up to go out and drown in an ocean of information. So if instead we adopt the perspective that studying history is about learning about the world that we live in, now we have a much more interesting outlook. And we have the ability to look back at the past selectively and find empowering information. We have to be careful about how we do that, because one of the temptations is that we have, as people have noted, we have prejudices or preferences that are not objective, and then we use those to justify choosing things in the past to look at. That would be subjective. So if we want to be objective, if we want our perspective on the past to be correct, then we have to try to strive for a perspective that gives us the whole truth. Not just a part of the truth, maybe, that's most comfortable to us. And so what we want to do is we take our observations about the present and try to see as clearly as we can what the world looks like, whether we like it or not. Whether we like to see Muslim terrorists in our world or not, they're there. Whether we like to see the way that Russia's behaving in Ukraine and America's stuck trying to deal with it or not, it's there. Whether we like the results of a particular election or not, in America, we just had one, right? It's there. And that's the present. And so we face that and we ask ourselves, how does that work? How did we get here? What's the world like? Let's understand it rather than merely react to it emotionally and get buffeted about in this very complex world that we don't get. One of the things about the world that we live in, which is a very important factor in the shape of it, is that there are multiple forms of Christianity. Not one. Christianity is not a unity of belief. And this is important for every single religion out there. One of the most important things about Islam, for instance, it is not a unity of belief either. And so, importantly with Islam, there are really only two, though, that matter the most. There are the Sunni and the Shia, two different kinds of Islam. Very important fact that has a lot to do with the shape of the Middle East today. And with regard to Christianity, there's a lot more variety. And that's an important factor in the shaping of the world that we live in. So, what happened? How did it get to be that way? Because in 1492, that was not the case. In 1492, in all the countries that we are concerned with, so let me go ahead and share my screen with you, right, and take us back to this interesting context. Oops, wait, sorry. I did the wrong thing. Share my desktop. If we go back to this context that we are interested in, then if we talk about Spain, Portugal, France, England, and all of this mess that we call the Holy Roman Empire, everybody there agrees on Christianity. Right? And in particular, in that agreement, part of that agreement is that Christianity is a religion with a leader. Who is it? Who's in the role of father figure, patriarch, or leader, or in some sense, controller and governor of this whole thing? Timothy?
Pope? The Pope? Or in the English translation, Papa?
Well, the other way around, right? Papa is Latin, and Pope is the English. I think that's what you meant, right? Right, yeah. So Papa's Latin for father, and he's over here in Rome. Let's go ahead and put him on our map. He's down here in Rome. And everybody, whether you are in what color, no matter what color you're in, as it turns out, some of you might know, already by 1492, there was already a split in Christianity. Does anybody know what it was? So, yes, for American history, really, for American history purposes, Christianity was pretty much kind of one religion. But as far as European history is concerned, it's actually quite significant to know that you could draw a line kind of like this through Europe, and that side over here was not the same. Over here, they didn't follow the Pope. So on the eastern side, Theo. Oh, hey, Theo, how are you? I saw your sister there today. I'm glad to have you.
Yeah. Is it the Russian Orthodox Church?
Well, yeah. So the Greek Orthodox, and in relation to that, Russian Orthodox. So Orthodox Christianity, indeed. Right, so that's a split that has persisted to this day. But as far as Western Europe is concerned, and the countries that have anything to do with American history and the founding of the United States and so on, they all agreed on the fact that Christianity should be a religion that involves, in some sense, loyalty to the Pope. That the Pope is the leader of people in some regard, that he gets to basically be the guy that decides whether or not something is Christian or not. And we saw this in the contest between popes and emperors. Right? I mean, that was a really crucial contest. Who's going to be in charge of the Holy Roman Empire? The Pope or the Emperor? And it was an argument that had not been settled yet. Right? Because we've got the green and we got the yellow, and they're on there for a reason. I put them on there for a reason because still, at this juncture, it's important to see that the emperors don't have a country yet. What they have is a bunch of different territories within the empire, which gives them more power than others, but not enough to control everything. So we have this particular situation in 1492, and we're going to get to, and we were thinking last time, right, that we might get a unification, that over time we might get a unification of these kingdoms because there was starting to be a trend, right? So what do we got? Where's our good buddies there? These characters, where are they? Hey, there they are. Two of our most important characters in our story, right? Ferdinand of Aragon and his wife, namely, over here, who's she? Bria, who is it?
Isabella.
Isabella of?
Castile.
Castile, right. Ferdinand of Aragon, Isabella of Castile. And they're showing us the way here. They're showing us the pattern. The pattern of non-military unification is dynastic marriage. If you can combine kingdoms and combine the bloodlines, then hopefully, in theory, you can get people to stop fighting wars against each other because the leaders are all members of the same family. What do you think? Good theory? Bad theory? Are you in a position to judge yet? Anybody have thoughts about that? Bria says it has flaws. Okay, are theoretical flaws? Any concrete examples, Timothy?
I agree. do it if you want to have the most power, but it's going to have its problems with the people not liking to combine. Like, if the Queen of France and the King of England, or the Princess of France and the Prince of England got married, I don't think that France and England would like that very much because they're worst enemies forever.
That's an interesting...
power-wise.
All right, so you're saying that one of the flaws in this particular arrangement is that it's one thing for the kings to say, this is going to be so. That's a unification at a high level in the hierarchy. But what you're saying is that doesn't generate a sense of commonality, a sense of participating in the same national identity on behalf of the people. In particular, if their history leads them to kind of have an instinctive hatred of each other. And they speak different languages. They have different traditions. So, yeah, you're only getting kind of an artificial unification. Bria?
If you have a prince from one country and a princess from another country, and they get married, say one group of people hates the princess, and one of the groups from the princess hates the prince.
Mm-hmm.
If that happens, there's going to be civil war.
Yeah, right. Okay, right. Right, so yeah, you've got loyalty issues, you've got internal issues of culture and so on. So yeah, dynastic marriage is one thing, but it's not necessarily going to result in a powerful unity unless the families are really, really committed to it. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. Right? If each of the rulers sees in their advantage, in dynastic marriage, an advantage, then we're going to take this family and we're going to merge them with this family. Right? We got Joanna of Castile and we're going to marry her to Philip of Austria. And therefore, these two territories are now governed by the same family. And then we're going to take Catherine of Aragon, and we're going to marry her to the King of England, so we're going to bring them in on the mix. And pretty soon we have Mr. Powell's famous formula for the dynastic integration of Europe, known as the Habsburg Sandwich, that Timothy regaled us with the court jester routine about that the other day. Thank you. So, the problem, of course, is that France doesn't want to be in that because France is France. And so, yeah, politically speaking, it's going to be a very difficult proposition to unify solely on the basis of dynastic marriage. Okay. So, now I'm suffering one of those consequences of being goofy sometimes, is that I let you guys loose and you guys feel like being goofy. Okay, let's rein that in. Let's rein that in and stay serious here. So, yes, we've got the Habsburg Sandwich. This is a geopolitical situation in which France is going to be, it's at the center of a situation where it's surrounded and is going to want to assert its independence and not be part of it. All right, so we're going to see that as an issue. Won't have time to get to it quite today, but definitely next week we'll finish up with it. So France is in this situation. And Bria, settle down. No more. All right, so. And so we're seeing a potential unification, but we know that it's going to be really hard to achieve. Now today, we're going to see something else happening here. So we're just going to step back from this political unity, and we're going to see that, well, something's going to happen over here, which is rather interesting. We'll put it somewhere up in here. Okay, so we're going to get another spot, and that's good enough. And so we're going to get somebody who is going to inject a whole new problem into our story. And that is, in the year 1517, crucial milestone here, somebody's going to say, out loud and proud something very scary and obnoxious to most people at the time. And that is, I refuse to follow the Pope. I do not accept the authority of the Pope. Now, this is not going to be the first time this has been said, and it's not an absolutely new thought, but the result is going to be earth-shattering for Christianity. Because in this instance, the situation was such that he was going to be able to get away with that. So on October 31st, 1517, this character, and some of you may already know who we're about to discuss here, Martin Luther is his name. So we're going to put him up here, somewhere up here in northern Germany. Martin Luther is going to say, I disagree with the Pope. Now, about what and for what reasons is more technical than we need to talk about in American history. Those of you who have studied European history with me have probably had some exposure to the dogma, the issues of dogma that were involved. The dogma has to do with things that you believe in that you hold to no matter what. And so, or doctrine in Christianity is also the idea in a religion of the certain ideas, the certain premises that are defended as the core beliefs of the religion. So when Martin Luther said, I disagree with the Pope, he was attacking the idea that the Pope gets to tell everybody what the religion should be. And he was insisting that, well, basically, on his own version of interpreting Christianity. And not surprisingly, the Pope wanted to snuff out any such thing. The Pope, hold on a second, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. As Theo was reminding us, Luther didn't just say, I disagree with the Pope. He published a tract or an essay list of 95 different things that he found that the Pope believed in that were wrong. So these are called the 95 Theses. Should probably put that in the chat for anybody who needs to write them out. So the Pope wrote out, Theo already wrote them, right? The 95 Theses, or 95 Ideas is another way of thinking of that, 95 arguments against the Pope, which is one heck of a disagreement. And so the Pope sent back another big list. It wasn't 86, Timothy, I can't remember the number. And the Pope argued, and it turned into just a big argument between two people who are never going to agree. And the main reason why is because the argument was as much about who gets to say as about what they are saying. So, and in history, what this amounts to, you know, I'm not going to pick sides here, and it would be inappropriate to say, one side was right or one side was wrong. This has to do, and people of different religious beliefs have really strong, you know, thoughts about this, really strong preferences about this. But the real point for history is not that people disagree about it. Well, actually, the real point is that that they disagree. And that we live in a world where they can disagree. That we live in a world where, as a result of the struggle between different authorities in Christianity, there came to be different versions that you could choose from. This is the so what, in fact, of this episode in history, which is often called the Reformation. The so what, and the reason why we're studying it is, we live in a world where if you're going to choose Christianity at all, because you don't even have to make that choice, but if you are a Christian and you want to adopt a Christian belief, you've got choices. Now, of course, you might be raised in one way or another by your parents, and you might be inclined to that or not. But in essence, in modern society, nobody can force you. And this is a thing of beauty that the Founding Fathers gave to us all as a gift. And it's called religious freedom. And they gave Americans that gift because they looked back at Europe and they saw Europeans slaughtering each other over their religious differences. Not different religions, but religious differences within Christianity. And they said, that's a recipe for disaster in any civilization. And therefore, the Founding Fathers said, we need a separation of church and state. We need to make it impossible to use the power of the government to impose religion. We'll come back to that in a minute. So we live in the outcome here of a big argument that resulted in there being different points of view. And then ultimately the Founding Fathers came along and said, well, because there are different points of view, this is a really revealing thing. People should not be able to use force with regard to religious beliefs. If we can make a society where we cut that off and we make that impossible, then we'll have a society of religious freedom. And the results are fantastic. So anyway, continuing on, that's the so what of this story here. This is the setup for it. Martin Luther is going to disagree with the Pope, and, well, this is not allowed, not in 1517. It's not allowed to disagree with the Pope, but in this time, one of the peculiarities of the story here, where's my colors? Hold on, view, where's, oh, stop annotating. Okay, there we go. I'm going to put the green back here because I'm going to get kind of the green. You know, it doesn't matter, but I've kind of mixed them up. So let's go ahead and put the green, because we had the green and the yellow mostly. So over here we got the green and the yellow. One thing that matters about this is that, again, why was there a green and a yellow? And I put Martin Luther up in kind of the top right-hand corner there somewhere. I don't know the exact location, but it was way up there. What was the deal with the green and the yellow? Why do we have that on our map? It's all the Holy Roman Empire, but... Keen?
I believe that the green is what the Habsburgs were in control of, and as they were sort of building their empire of sorts. It's not really an empire in the traditional sense as far as imperialism and conquest go, but as they were building these lands that were in control of the Habsburg family, it's fair and historically significant for us to denote them and separate them from the rest of everything.
Okay, right. All right, so the greens is the Habsburgs and the yellows not. Right, so they're the emperors, but man, they do not control this whole thing. That's the reason. Okay, they don't control the whole thing. The yellow belongs to other people. So when the Pope gets upset with Martin Luther, he calls the Holy Roman Empire and says, "Do your duty." The Holy Roman Empire, Holy Roman Emperor, I keep misspeaking there, is his job to, he's the sword, right? He's the sword of Christianity. So if a job needs to get done, it's his job to do. And so if Martin Luther is disagreeing with the Pope and he won't be quieted, then he needs to be forced to be quiet. And it's the emperor's job to go do it. And so Martin Luther is in trouble, except he's living in the yellow part. He's living in the yellow part. Bria, go ahead.
This is actively about having two different parts owning.
Mm-hmm.
One part is when you're trying to travel from one place to the other, and people are like, "Where are you coming from?" And then you tell them what, and then you're like, "I'm gonna kill you." It's really dangerous.
Well, okay, yeah, right. This creates this discontinuity here. Does create challenges because there was no freedom of movement in those times. So yeah, it was definitely difficult to move around, and that has a lot to do with what's about to happen because the emperor's got the green lands and he's got to go into the yellow lands and deal with Luther. Meanwhile, Luther's got supporters. he's gradually convincing more and more people that he's right and the Pope is wrong. So over here, up in Northern Europe, there's going to be a series of supporters, and they've got a quite funny name for them. And why? Oh, I got the wrong color. How did I get the wrong color? So that's really weird. When I wanted to type it on screen for you guys. There we go. All right. So he's got an alliance of leaders called the Schmalkaldic League. An alliance of lords here in the yellow area who are not followers of the Habsburgs, who are not loyal to the Habsburgs. And so they are, and they form an alliance in a town in Germany called Schmalkalden. And so it's called the Schmalkaldic League. So the emperor wants to silence Luther over his 95 disagreements with the Pope. And he can't do it because they have a war. And they are not able to defeat the Schmalkaldic League. And the outcome of Martin Luther's contest with the Pope and the war between the Emperor and the Schmalkaldic League is a peace treaty. Hold on for a sec, Bria. And the peace treaty is called the Peace of Augsburg. I keep typing these on screen just to make sure that you've got them all. Peace of Augsburg, 1555. We'll put that there too. Why not? All right, so the Pope and the Emperor fight the Schmalkaldic League. They can't defeat them, and they make a bargain at the end of that war in 1555. As all of this age of discovery is unfolding, right? And as that story of exploration is unfolding, this is also happening in parallel. And the Peace of Augsburg is a bargain that allows the success of Lutheranism, that allows the survival of Lutheranism. Okay, Bria, go ahead.
I'm just going to add something that's going to go away a little bit. Martin brings in an idea that's kind of like as far out of space as aliens. It's like something that's totally against all traditions. And because of that, everybody wants him to either have to take the Pope's side or his side, and it kind of adds another dimension to this whole thing. Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite go that far as to say that Martin Luther's ideas are new or alien. And I don't think he would have thought that either. In fact, what I would say is Martin Luther was really thinking that it was the ideas of the Pope that were wrong and alien. That it was the Popes that had changed Christianity in ways that were wrong, and that he himself was bringing back a more traditional truth. And so, they were against each other, but Martin Luther would say that his version of Christianity is more like the original, or is indeed the correct form, the original form, the true form, and it's the Pope that's introduced the alien ideas. So anyway, that's details, though, because we'd have to get in to figure that out. We'd have to get into all kinds of interesting things having to do, for instance, with the Renaissance and other things going on. So the popes at this time are very different characters than they've ever been. But yes, you know, they've got a disagreement, and that's what matters. And at other times, you're not allowed to have a disagreement with the Pope. And Martin Luther's got the support of the Schmalkaldic League, and therefore the Pope cannot silence him, cannot destroy Lutheranism. And at the end, in 1555, we end up with a milestone for history. One of the most important milestones for history. It's called the Peace of Augsburg. And in that peace, the Emperor and the Schmalkaldic League made an arrangement. And the arrangement is captured by a Latin phrase, which is of great significance. I'm going to type it in the chat. The Latin phrase, some of you will remember and recognize immediately. There it is. The Latin phrase is, cuius regio, eius religio. Yes, and Theo's like, oh yeah, I remember. What does it mean? cuius regio, eius religio. The veterans here, I'm sure, are having their minds. Theo, go ahead.
Ruler chooses the religion.
The ruler chooses the religion. So, if you are a member of the Small Caldic League and you accept the Lutheran form of Christianity, then you get to be a Lutheran. And if you are the Habsburg Emperor and you accept the Catholic form of Christianity, following the Pope, then you get to be Catholic. Now, but notice, however, what this means more deeply and profoundly. The ruler chooses the religion. What does that mean? It does mean something for the rulers, but what else does it mean? And this is where we're going to do some interconnected thinking here. What else does it mean? The ruler chooses the religion. Timothy.
It means that the ruler could literally choose any religion, and that would have to be the accepted religion. They could worship pizza.
No. Stop right there. Not in this case. No. The Peace of Augsburg only offers two choices. Lutheranism or Catholicism. Only two. At some point, yes, further down the line, we are going to get further towards that idea, Timothy. But at this point, we only got two choices. So it's not so much how many choices there are, though. It's what it is that this formulation means. What does it mean to say the ruler chooses the religion? It's not, notice, saying the ruler chooses his own religion. What does it say? What's the difference? What's the difference between saying the ruler chooses his religion and the ruler chooses the religion? Peyton, tell me the difference.
What, can you remind me of the question really quick?
What's the difference between saying the ruler chooses his own religion and the ruler chooses the religion?
Well, the ruler chooses the religion, and the other one, the religion just maybe chooses itself?
No. Try again. Listen here. The ruler chooses his own religion. That's a personal thing. Now listen to this sentence. The ruler chooses the religion.
Well, one of them has the, so it could be like maybe one's more personal than the other.
Yes, indeed. That's the key here. So what could it possibly mean? If we're going to have a different formulation, what could it mean to say chooses his own religion, and then the other one says chooses the religion? Declan, can you decipher this?
The ruler chooses a religion. I believe it means that. So the ruler chooses either Lutheranism or Catholic.
Yes.
That is the intended religion throughout his entire empire.
Okay, now we're getting there. We're talking about rulers. And when we say the religion, we mean the religion in his entire territory. This is huge. Because we're talking rulers. So we're not talking a universe in which people get to choose their own religion. We're not talking about a world in which there's any freedom. Right? If a ruler chooses a religion, what happens to the people in his territory? What happens to them? King.
Well, their ruler has just come up with a new way to bind them, yet another way to restrict their freedom. They have less choice and they have to follow this religion.
They have to follow it. That's it. They have to follow him. Okay, so now here's where we're going to go with this. Because I want you to start. See, it seemed like a challenging identification. That's good. This is where it's at. I want to go back to this. We've been interconnecting history. We've been learning how to do that. Now we have a new situation. We're going to do here. Where's my toolbars? Okay, good. So now what we're going to do is we're going to put a new milestone. The milestone goes here. Well, actually, I'm going to put it down here because, okay, 1555. I'm going to put it a little bit higher. Okay, 1555. Cuius regio. Eius religio. There we go. All right? And I'm going to put a black line marking it to where it belongs on the calendar, right? Because that's what the black lines are for. Oh, I don't want arrows. Okay, get rid of the arrows, just a sec. Okay, and I want it to be... All right, so that we're going to have 1555 over here. Ugh, I'm having trouble with this. It's going to go all the way. Where does it go? It goes here, right? After Columbus. All right, so now we've got a new milestone on our timeline. And what I want to do is this. Think about, I want to encourage you to think about this, right? Is if this is the case, don't really need that one. What would be a good, right? Let's pin this kind of to our timeline there, okay? 1555, cuius regio, eius religio. Now I want you to see this event and understand it in relation to all of history. Can you do that? Can you bring in the information that you know about the past and use it to understand the past? So, here's what I mean. We're going to do light blue lines today. Okay. Oh, wrong idea. This one. Light blue lines. Okay. I want you to take me from this to this. How does our anchored understanding of history reveal, inform, assist us in understanding the events of 1555? If we know history properly, if we know that Jesus is born in 4 BC, how does that help us with 1555? It does. What does it tell us? Timothy's on to something here. Go ahead, Timothy.
Well, it tells us since cuius regio eius religio means the ruler chooses the religion. When Jesus was born, that started Christianity, and pretty much the choices, they were different types, but the ruler only had the choice between Lutheranism and Catholicism, which are both forms of Christianity.
There we go. We're talking about an event which can only make sense in relation to the birth of Jesus, because what we're talking about is two different versions of Christianity. Okay. See how Timothy did that? Let's do this one. Let's interconnect. What about manes narmer and cuius regio eius religio? Can you draw a connection? Do you see that these things connect? Theo.
It's the ruler chooses the religion, not the people chooses
the religion. Okay, the ruler. There we go. So the ruler is the guy who's in charge. So we have a society of rulers, right? And we are in 1555. So, all right. So now we better make a connection over here, right? So, all right. So run with it now. Theo has given us this crucial insight, right? Okay, the ruler chooses the religion. Stay as long as you can, Bria. So, 1776, let's take this. What's the connection now between 1555 and 1776? Keen.
Well, in a similar way, since men is in a similar way to how we think, well, since men is normal, all the way up, all through history until 1776, we have this precedent of monarchy where the ruler is ruling other people with force. We have now, from 1555 until 1776, we have this precedent of the ruler doesn't just rule people by force, but he also forces them to follow one religion. And then in 1776, here's a new idea, or there may be the rebirth of an old idea, that's stretching it, that the people can choose their own religion.
There we go! Finally, in 1776, now we have a new appreciation of 1776. Because back in 1555, we've got ruler chooses the religion. Of 1776, you choose! You are free! You have individual rights, and included in those is whether you, what religion you want to have, whether you want to have one or not, any of those. It's called freedom of religion. So this is really deeply, really profoundly deep here that 1555, we still have the mens norma situation. But it's not. Now here's another good interconnection. Connect these. Why do we study, why do we anchor our understanding of history to the fall of Rome? Why do we do that? Bria?
Didn't they have a lot of rulers that make all rules for everyone?
Okay, so after Rome, we don't have a single ruler. There's not one mens norma, there are... many. There are many mens norma, right? There's Germany, there's Portugal, there's France, there are the Habsburgs within the empire and the non-Habsburgs, there's the King of England, there's all the others. So when we get to, right, cuius regio, eius religio, what's that going to result in? Are we going to get one Christianity? No. What we're going to get is many. Because we're in a European world. A European world is one in which there are many regios. And therefore, there are many religios. Okay? Alright, so now look at this, how it makes sense. If you can, what you can do with any significant event in history is what we have just done here. Now, tell me now, then. See if you can do this. Keep going, keep going. Can you do this one? What do we do with that? We can interconnect every single one. Bria?
Well, Columbus had to get permission from a king and queen who had chosen a religion, and they had to follow it.
Okay, right, so one part of that, that's great, Bria, that's one of the things we're going to see, but we're going to see so much more. One of them is, Columbus is sailing for a Catholic king and queen. When he gets to America, it's going to be, one of the main themes is going to be the spreading of Catholic Christianity. Okay, anything else? Well, one of the themes is what I've been highlighting so far, is that when these guys after Columbus in this age of discovery, when the Europeans are spreading out into the world, they are going to be spreading multiple forms of Christianity. Because we are after Jesus, but we also are after cuius regio now. So cuius regio says some of them are going to spread Lutheranism, some of them are going to spread Calvinism, as you will see, some of them are going to spread Anglicanism. We'll talk about those on Monday. And so this means that the world is going to have lots of versions of Christianity. Bria, continue.
One of the things is that since Columbus didn't sail for all the other rulers, and that the fact that he's sailing for a Catholic king and queen means that everybody else is going to be jealous and they're going to want to be in the snow too.
Yeah, very nice, very good, right. So that's one of the reasons why England, as we will see, just wants to do its own thing, is because, well, we're going to see that England is going to have a different, form of Christianity, basically. And now Theo's going to make a connection. Whoa, fantastic. This is a very important, there cannot be a more important connection than to 9/11. So Theo, go ahead, other than 1776, that's the most important. Theo.
Because of religious freedom, the terrorists attacked America.
Absolutely. One of the reasons. Why? Why do you say that?
Because they want everything to be unified under a single religion, and America has probably hundreds of thousands of
them. Not that many, but it definitely has thousands of different kinds of belief, right? And freedom causes that, that people get to basically make up their own minds. So yeah, so we have the Muslim terrorists, and in Islam, you do not have the concept of religious freedom. So societies that are Islamic have a very different outlook, that they want to impose religion using the power of the state, and that's what they do. That they are the same as our popes and our emperors, they are the same as our menes and our narmers, but they are Muslim. So we live in a time where this has happened, where the founding fathers have made a society of religious freedom, and it's no surprise then that the United States of America is locked in a struggle with Islamic civilization, which holds the old premise that you can force people to hold a certain religious belief. So yeah, it makes complete sense that we have reached this post 9/11 juncture where we have this terrible, terrible conflict. Because Islam does not promote the idea of religious freedom any more than Christianity once did. But because Christianity was broken up into multiple countries, that's the fall of Rome part, and we're talking about a European civilization, well, we have separate countries, and we've got cuius regio. That leads to more wars between people with different beliefs, and ultimately the founding fathers, wait a minute, let's stop all this nonsense. Let's have some freedom. Amazing. All of history flows together. All of it. So interconnection. All right. That was cool. I hope you guys liked seeing how you can take every single one of our anchors and link it to cuius regio. I mean, Athens and Roman Republic, not so much, because they've already, you can link them indirectly, right? Because you would have, you know, these guys, this fails, and that's kind of an indirect link. But basically, it all links and interlinks. And so, your cuius regio is not just a separate fact that you might know about this or that. What it is a doorway into of all of history. You should be able to think of Menes Narmer when you are thinking of the Reformation. You should be able to think of the Founding Fathers when you're thinking of it. And even, yes, of the attacks of 9/11 in relation to that. That's what it means to have powerful historical knowledge. Everything connects to everything else in your mind. I hope you see the connections, because they probably end up on the test. I think they're going to end up on the test. The blue lines are going to be on the test, because this is where it's at. Interconnection is knowledge. So, anyway, we are well over time and we gotta go. Anyway, good job working through that. I'm impressed, and I think we're in a good situation here. If you're not sure about this whole interconnection thing, start asking questions and get comfortable. Because tomorrow I'm going to introduce the first interconnection paragraph. And I have a feeling we're going to have to do an interconnection in-class interconnection paragraph on 1555 as well. And it might end up on the test. All right. So, good. That's it for today. Tomorrow's History Through Art, of course. And like I said, I'm gonna introduce the first writing assignment tomorrow as well. Thanks, guys. Good work. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Mr. Barlow.